This is the second lecture of the second teaching cycle, lecture number 9 in this series on the human soul. It seems to many astronomers today that one of the most complex products of a supernova, beyond the creation of basic elemental matter in its atomic form, such that it can eventually be brought together to form the substance of what becomes planets, is possibly the formation of the very seed of life that we call a virus or a viroid. We find viruses in space. We find them up as high into the atmosphere as we can go. We find them on the moon. We find higher concentrations of them in the upper atmosphere than we do in the lower atmosphere. And not only do they go through developments on an 11-year cycle with the sunspots, which is basically a cycle of radiant activity, and virus-like creatures, which are submicroscopic and resemble not any kind of life form that we know, but more crystals, little crystalline seeds of DNA RNA. These things are very, very responsive to the solar cycles, and they mutate very, very fast because they're so tiny that just one direct hit with some kind of radiation can change their genetic structure, change their program, their little computer program, and create literally tens of thousands of multiform possibilities every hour. If we were to take a computer disk, you know that when some kind of electromagnetic force passes near a computer disk, usually it glitches. Some little glitch happens, some bits are lost or something like that. But if the disk is glitched just exactly in the right way, it can be improved. And this only happens in very rare occasions. I've never had it happen with any of mine. But it theoretically could happen. It does happen with viruses. Viruses are kind of the fluid computer program matrix of the universe. And it's speculated by many scientists now that the way that life begins on planets is through the encounter, through the existence in the matter, already the planets, and the encounter of clouds of viruses that slowly settle down into planets and become the basic seeds for life forms that will eventually develop over billions of years. Whether this is a fact or not, we do know that biological life starts from submicroscopic origins and slowly builds itself into great structures which are microscopic, and that those then come together in further evolutions to form colonies and groups that of cooperative cells, and that these eventually form more complex structures, and finally the most complex biological structures and forms and vehicles that we know, and that these structures contain within them the patterns of the earlier ones. If we look at our own body, we see our bloodstream, which contains within it the pattern of the ocean and of the one-celled life that lives in water, the amoeba, the leukocytes, the white blood cells. If we look at our organs, we look at our digestive organs, we see the basic shape of the worm and the pattern of the worm and the very process of the worm. If we look at our liver or other kinds of organs, we see something like a sponge and so on. And we find that all the information that has been built up, everything that works and everything that has been able to survive and able to hold itself together in form, is built into what we are as in our anatomy, our basic physiology and anatomy. And so it is that evolution in a biological sense then is a process of incorporating and bringing together and holding and carrying on through to higher or more complex forms patterns that were developed very early on. The pattern of human reproduction is a pattern that exists as one of many possibilities on the one cell level. And the process of birth and of budding, as in flowers, or of germinating, or any of the other processes that we see in higher forms, exists in a much more narrow way in simpler and smaller forms. So we carry within the patterns of our bodies the earlier and more primitive patterns of biological evolution. And so if one were to take Freud's famous statement that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is a way of saying that the development of the individual recapitulates or shows over again the development of the whole species or the whole race, as, for example, with the formation of a human in the womb of a woman, which starts out going through forms that through exterior forms that go through fish-like stages and then amphibious-like stages and then reptilian stages and so on, and until finally the complexity of the human organism is filled out. Or if we talk about a brain surgeon, a brain structures, the parts of the brain that we call the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and so on, which overlap and form greater and greater layers and so on, and the possibilities that are inherent. Or in any other ways, we can see that we as human beings hold within us the pattern of all the animal, the vegetable, and the mineral kingdoms. And therefore, we have passed through all these kingdoms in some sense biologically. Now, we haven't passed through every single thing there is in the mineral kingdom and every single thing there is in the animal kingdom and so on, but we have passed through. We have joined together and we have remembered and apprehended and held things from this in something that is very often represented as a chalice. When we speak of the human soul, the chalice is a symbol for that which holds essences of things that are experienced in incarnate life from lifetime to lifetime, not just as one species, but as all species. And there are fancy names that you can find in Vedanta and other kinds of systems of thought. But I don't follow any particular of these because, and I don't write out what I'm saying about this sort of thing because to try to organize information about the soul into categories that are like a summa psychica, a summa theologica, some kind of great organized group of things like I did last week talking about postulates, basic postulates of human spiritual reality. To try to organize things in that way, we become very intellectual and we end up leaving things out. So when I speak about these things, I speak about them rather poetically, and I'll draw things in eclectically from lots of different systems, because what's happening as I speak is that you're listening not just to my words, but you're also connecting with the same energy I'm connecting with, and thoughts and ideas and inspirations are coming to you independently of what I'm saying, simply because we're gathered here for this purpose. That's why all great teaching and all effective teaching is done orally. The ear is a birth canal. it looks like a birth canal, the cochlea and so on. And it has been historically a birth canal. The eyes are not. The eyes have other very special uses, but the ear is a birth canal, and that's why when they teach about, for example, I introduced you to the powers and potencies of sound and harmonics, that is why that it is through chanting, singing, and through spoken words, and through other kinds of sounds that are interior sounds and inaudible sounds, that we are able to synthesize and connect and bring into our lower minds higher information. So as I speak about the human soul, I'll speak in an eclectic and in a poetic way rather than in an organized situation from notes and from premises and postulates and so on. And I'm simply calling to your attention the fact that just as in the biological level, the level of biological life, there is a not only a logical sequence of evolutionary progression through the mineral and vegetable and animal and human kingdoms and beyond the human kingdom, so to speak, there is also in psychic life a progression. It begins with smaller, less expanded, more specific, and less what kind of word do I want to say? More very smaller, but far less articulate forms of consciousness. And these forms develop. These forms develop. They gradually over lives, they gain accumulations, just as we can speak of the chalice, which is in terms of the human structure of energy, is located from the solar plexus to the throat. And this thing that accumulates or that oversees the accumulations has been called in many systems the monad. The monad is simply a Greek word meaning the unity, the unitative thing. Now, it's not an ego in the sense of something that has the identity of an I, but it is an ego in the sense that it is the organizing principle and the single unity behind which many, 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 many lives of all kinds are synthesized, and it's kind of the ruling principle that guides these things. If we were to talk of the evolution of the monad itself does not evolve. It's like a light that just puts out a ray that comes from the sun. It's like a ray from the sun that just is there. It doesn't get any brighter. It doesn't get any dimmer. It just is. But as it is qualified through different planes of reality, and as its influence is actuated and felt through the process of creation, which has been going on from time immemorial and will go on into time immemorial, is going on right now, because all souls are coming into existence in a stream. They didn't all just start at once and boom, there they are. They come in a stream. As the monad pushes itself into extends its influence into different planes of reality and existence, then different kinds of life are created and sparked in those realities. And a human being is the crown and sum and substance of a very ancient eonic development, monadic development, that goes back to the very roots of time, but it has a beginning in terms of its externalization into the physical, to the physical world, to the material world. Now, not all rays from the sun, so to speak, are what we call monads. There are other kinds of things. We can speak, for example, of angels or angelic beings and devas and different kinds of things that don't have physical form and take physical bodies. And we can read in great teachings that angelic beings, or so to speak, who are seen in the Hebrew tradition, for example, as hypostases or emanations of the powers of the divine. Raphael, all the angels end with El, which means of God or God or of God, and the first part has to do with their function. Raphael, healing of God or healer of God, and so on. The angelic names are angelic powers of the divine. They don't manifest as individual beings, and they don't incarnate. But that isn't because they are superior to human beings in any way. As a matter of fact, human beings are the only kind of externalization from that central divine origin that have the power to go to the nethermost regions of reality, into this plane of matter, and to go through an arduous evolution over eons of time to finally create what we call a human being, to create that achievement. In Tibetan Buddhism, it is said the greatest birth, the most wonderful birth a person can have, is that of a human being. Not, and that's even to be preferred to that of a god, for example. Gods live very long and have very happy lives, but eventually they fall back into samsaric reality and they have to deal with their karma and so on. But human being is the ideal place. It is the crowning achievement of nature, of physical matter, and it is the gateway to the development of the monad, the return of the monad, fully realized, not fully realized, but realized fully in the material existence on its return. On its return to the central unity from which it came. And so one can visualize the whole process of creation and the greatest meaning of human life as the coming forth of a ray or a part or a spark from the one divine that finally penetrates into the nethermost regions of reality, the most chaotic and the least formed, as part of creation, that comes into these regions and begins to organize it and bring its light more and more and more into these regions, until finally it has achieved this and is able to then begin its journey back. And in the journey back, as it slowly goes back over eons of time, it lifts up and brings back to it a perfection in creation. And so that when the final return is achieved, then an entire cycle of creation has been achieved. But it doesn't all come out in one clunk. It isn't as though, boom, in a sort of initial big bang, rays of the divine were sent out into all places, and now they're all coming back, because the rays are shining at all times, they're going out at all times. And for that reason, psychic life comes forth into the physical world, physical manifestation, as a stream in time. And we can therefore very correctly speak about younger souls and older souls. And the soul, we use the term soul, psyche, in the West to mean things that are described in other ways in other systems, among Hindus, among the Buddhists. The soul is not a thing that is unchanging. The soul is something that grows. The soul is the first coherent manifestation of the monad, the monadic influence in the physical world, and it belongs to everything that manifests in form. A blade of grass, and to the whole species of grass, to a piece of a pure metal like gold, and to the whole species of gold, to a clod of earth that contains all kinds of minerals, to each individual one-celled organism and of all sorts, all the way to a human being. And the monad that lies behind me and you is the same monad and of the same value and of the same power as the one that lies behind a blade of grass or a a tree or a beaver or any other thing that manifests as an organism in form that has a consciousness that says I. Now, the consciousness of I is actually a very elusive, rather illusory concept, because the only way we can think of ourselves accurately is to refer to ourselves as we. Because I am a concatenation, I am a harmony, I am a bringing together of billions of lives, And they exist throughout my body. I can speak of the cellular life of my body. I can speak of the on the unseen level of the various patterns of life that are contained in me that I have preserved through my monadic journey through incarnation after incarnation from the mineral kingdom on up to the human kingdom. And I therefore will have special affinities with certain minerals. Not all minerals, but with certain minerals. With certain plants, vegetables, trees, fruits. With certain areas, certain places on the earth. With certain animals. And with certain families of other souls, of other human souls. I will have special relationships, and each of us has this. And it was said in the teachings I've mentioned before, in the teachings of the master Omram Ivanhof, who was the chela of the Bulgarian master Vensa Dvomov, Peter Dvomov, that in the European master tradition, it was always said that there was some place on the earth where each person had a certain ground or territory that related very directly, karmically, to that person. So that, to put it in rather melodramatic terms that really aren't applicable, that when that person dies, something happens to that place, or to that mineral, or to this animal, or to this other, or to these, you know, it's not just between people that relationships exist. Relationships exist between us and all of nature, because we're a part of it, we're the conscious part of nature. And it's also not correct for us to call ourselves I, because we are a symphony of beings, and we are also part of a much greater symphony. If we were four body cells, and we were sitting inside of the body of a great human being, waiting for lunch, waiting for the red platelets to come down the pike here, and we were going to share some, and then they would go on somewhere else, and we were having a philosophical conversation. And one of us were to say, you know, I don't understand how you can believe in the existence of man. I've never seen man. This man that you talk about is so great and so huge, we'd never be able to see him. You say that we're inside man, and yet we are man, and yet man is the ruler of all this universe around us, and it's man who sends us the little red blood platelets, and it's man who decides exactly how many platelets we each get and shares them equally throughout the universe and keeps everything in balance and so on. But I can't imagine being man and being man at the same time and being inside of man and part of man at the same time. And perhaps one of the other body cells with a more philosophical bent might say, well, that's true. We've never seen man, but we apprehend man through our finer consciousness, and we understand, we can see the workings of man all around us. We can see that everything is functioning in a harmony and in a non-chaotic way, and that we always get exactly what we need in terms of these platelets that come down with their oxygen and so on and all this sort of thing. So if we were to look inside of our bodies and to focus ourselves on the consciousness of cells at a certain cellular level, we could see that even at a cellular level there might be questions about what am I part of and what's part of me and all this sort of thing. And if we can see all this clearly, we can see that it's really at any point when we say I, we're saying it in a very qualified way, because the I changes. there was a time when I was this big, and then I was this big, and then I was this big. If we could run the film real fast, I would look pretty funny. I just grow up and explode. That's I, you know. And if I run it real fast, I'd look like a machine gun, you know. If we look at the mountains and the hills around us and we could run the frames by real fast, we'd see the mountains growing and crumbling and growing like waves in an ocean. We'd see everything moving in this way. And so the concept that we have of very solid, simple, straightforward, immobile reality doesn't bear out as we come to have a greater understanding of how things are. And the consciousness that we have of I doesn't really work for the long term. It only works for the moment of time we're in at each time, and we can have a consciousness of I. But many people can experience many different ego states within even 2 minutes. The Master Jesus, when he was speaking to his disciples before he entered into Jerusalem for what would eventually become his crucifixion, spoke to his disciples and he said, "Who do you think I am? What do you think I am?" And Peter was the one who was able to answer what was the right answer for the understanding of the people at that time. And Jesus complimented him and he said, "Wonderful are you, Peter. You are only God could have revealed this to you. You are a wonderful being." And about a minute later, he started telling people how he had to go in and suffer and be crucified. And Peter said, "No, we won't allow this. You can't do that." And immediately turned around and he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Peter turned from a wonderful being to a Satan in 2 minutes here. And we do this all the time. We can go, I've gone myself, and all of us can go, and you've probably seen people go from one ego state to another ego state, and we don't even know we're going into two different ego states. But if we have no continuity between those ego states, then we suffer. We have psychological problems. But we string all these ego states together and call it I. One, we're feeling down about ourselves one day. Another day, we're up and everything's fine. Those are two very different ego states, and you can do very different things with those two different ego states. And as you swing through all the ego states that you go through, from high meditation down to confrontation with a policeman about a traffic ticket, all these swings in ego states we go through are like octaves of music, and they contain different forms of consciousness. They are, in fact, different forms of expansion of self. Now, the people who are the most selfish people are the least expanded in their egos. And the people who are the most generous and the most loving and the most tolerant are the most expanded in their egos. So by ego and by self, what we mean is something very different than what a selfish person would mean by self. Because a person who's in a very selfish ego state says, "I, myself, me," he separates himself from everything, from animal, plant, humanity, everything else, and sets himself up as the God of the universe, as his own, as the center of all things, and as the important element in all reality. Whereas the person who performs a sacrificial act, an unselfish act, truly an act of love for love's sake only, a person who's in that ego state does not see boundaries to himself, and he, in fact, is able to see the suffering of other people and feel it as though it's his own suffering. And he is able to be in other people and in other beings around him and other natural beings in trees and in animals. A person who sees an animal suffering and suffers is part of that animal and is experiencing I as part of that animal. And that is the expanded self. And that's what's meant when we talk about God or deity as the one self of the universe. It means the consciousness that includes all this. And when we go into meditation, we go within and we expand into, we never
can be in this consciousness. You know, we can never fill this consciousness out. We just expand as much as we're capable of expanding. And when we're sitting as expanded egos in this way, we're approaching our higher ego, our higher self. And that ego still says I. But when we finally achieve what might be called monadic consciousness, if we were to achieve, we're able to experience it, there's nothing we couldn't remember. We couldn't take it back with us. It would be gone. There was nothing, no categories. We couldn't put it into space and time and words and colors and tastes, anything comprehensible to us. All we'd do is come back with a feeling of either void or maybe just sort of light or something like that. This kind of awareness just wouldn't last. It can't stay down here because we can't grasp it. We don't have a big enough chalice to hold it in. We just can come back and, you know. So we work within the framework of what we have. And if an ape were suddenly be able to be, well, let's take a better example, say an ant. We'd have an ant and we take the consciousness of an ant and he's crawling across the floor. And his consciousness about what the universe is and all these things, and he has seven words he can speak and all this kind of stuff. And if you could be in that consciousness, in the consciousness of that ant, you would be unconscious as far as you're concerned. You wouldn't be subconscious, you'd be totally unconscious. Because you couldn't take anything back from that with you. And if the ant could go into your consciousness for 5 minutes and then go back to his own, there wouldn't be anything to hold there. But there is, in fact, a connection. One of the points of spiritual practices is to build what we call the antakarana, which is the connecting parts between the different ego states that we are.